Part 4, Yahweh and His Portion. Chapter 16, Abraham's World. We learn from Deuteronomy 32:8-9 that Yahweh placed the nations under the governance of junior Elohim, the sons of God of His divine counsel. Having disinherited humanity, unwilling as it was to fulfill the mandate of Eden to overspread the earth, he decided it was time to start over. The readers of Genesis get the feeling that the new beginning was almost immediate, as the Tower of Babel story is immediately followed by the call of Abram. Abram was, of course, the original name of Abraham. God called this Mesopotamian man, seemingly out of the blue, to leave his extended family and journey to a foreign locale. God entered into a covenant with him, changed his name to Abraham, and then enabled him and his wife to produce a son, Isaac, in their advanced age. Isaac, in turn, became the father of Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. Simple, right? It won't surprise you when I say there's much more going on than meets the eye. Abram is about to meet his God, but for Abraham's protection, God must come to the man in a way that blunts the light out of his own glory and helps Abraham process him as a person. The joy of Abraham. We first encounter God's covenant promises to Abraham in Genesis 12, but that chapter isn't the beginning of God's dealing with Abraham. In Genesis 12, Abraham is not in Mesopotamia. He's in a place north of Canaan called Haran, Genesis 12:4. To understand the real beginning of God's contact with Abraham, let's back up. After the Babel episode, the remainder of Genesis 11 is devoted to a genealogy, the genealogy of Abraham, back to Noah's son, Shem. Genealogies often contain something important or interesting, and this one is no exception. Compare the last two verses of Abraham's genealogical roots, Genesis 11:31-32, with Acts 7:2-4, and you'll discover that Yahweh first contacted Abraham before he got to Haran, and it was more than a conversation in his head. In Acts 7:2-4, Stephen says, "The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, before he settled in Haran, and said to him, 'Go out from your land and from your relatives, and come to the land that I will show you.' Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. And from there, after his father died, he caused him to move to this land in which you now live." The important element to catch here is in that first line, Yahweh appeared to Abraham. Abraham's first divine encounter in Mesopotamia involved a visible appearance of Yahweh. Genesis 12 is a follow-up. Abraham and Yahweh had talked before, face to face. That's also what happened in Genesis 12. We're most familiar with the first three verses. "And Yahweh said to Abraham, 'Go out from your land and from your relatives and from the house of your father to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse, and all families of the earth will be blessed in you.'" Genesis 12:1-3. But verses 6-7 deserve closer attention. "And Abram traveled through the land up to the place of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanites were in the land at that time, and Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, 'To your offspring I will give this land.' And he built there an altar there to Yahweh who had appeared to him." Verses 6-7. Twice in these two verses we read that Yahweh appeared to Abraham. A close reading of Genesis chapter 12 through 50 tells us that visible manifestations is a normal choice of Yahweh with respect to Abraham and his descendants, the patriarchs. This brings us to Genesis 15, 1-6, where the covenant of Genesis 12, 1-3 is repeated and ratified by a covenantal ceremony. The description of the person speaking to Abram here is even more startling. Note the emphasis in bold. After these things, the words of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. And your reward shall be great." Then Abram said, "O Yahweh, my Lord, what will you give me? I continue to be childless, and my heir is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "Look, you have not given me a descendant, and here a member of my household is my heir. And behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, 'This person will not be your heir, but your own son will be your heir.' And he brought him outside and said, 'Look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' And he believed in Yahweh and reckoned it to him as righteousness." Genesis 15, 1-6. This is a fascinating text. Notice right from the start that it is the word of Yahweh who comes to Abram in a vision. As before, the encounter was a visible manifestation of Yahweh. The word here is something that can be seen. Why else call it a vision? In verse 4, we read that the word brought him, Abraham, outside to continue the conversation. This isn't the kind of language one would expect if Abraham was hearing only a sound. These appearances of the word in Yahweh, word of Yahweh, are the conceptual backdrop to the Apostle John's language in his gospel that Jesus was the word. The most familiar instance is John 1:1. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And John 1:14, "And the Word became flesh and took up residence among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth." But John says some equally dramatic things in connection with this idea that are less familiar. In John 8:56, Jesus, the incarnate Word, informs his Jewish antagonists that he appeared to Abraham prior to his incarnation. "Abraham, your father rejoiced that he would see my day, and when he saw it and was glad." And he saw it and was glad. The Jews object vehemently to this claim, whereupon Jesus utters his famous statement, "Before Abraham was, I am." John 8:58. Only Genesis 12 and 15 provide the coherent backdrop for this claim. I hope you grasp the significance of the interchange. Since the word is clearly equated with and identified as Yahweh in Genesis 12 and 15, when the New Testament has Jesus saying, "That was me," he was claiming to be the word of the Old Testament who was the visible Yahweh. This understanding is also behind some of the things Paul says about Abraham and Jesus. In Galatians 3:8, Paul says that the gospel, that God would justify the Gentile nations, was preached to Abraham. This is clear reference to the content of the Abrahamic covenant delivered personally and visibly by the word. Yahweh visible and embodied. The fact that the Old Testament at times has Yahweh appearing in visible form should now be on your radar. We're going to see a lot more of him, pun intended. One of my favorite passages that features Yahweh made visible is 1 Samuel 3, the story of the young, soon-to-be prophet Samuel. Many readers will no doubt be familiar with it. The chapter opens with the cryptic statement, "The word of Yahweh was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread." The reader is predisposed by the comment to expect a vision of the word of Yahweh. Samuel keeps hearing a voice calling his name while he's trying to sleep. He He assumes it's the voice of the priest Eli and goes to the elderly man, but it was not Eli who spoke. After hearing the voice a third time, Eli realizes that it is Yahweh who's calling and instructs Samuel how to respond if it happens again. Samuel goes back to bed. The narrative resumes in verse 10. Then Yahweh came and stood there and called out as before, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, because your servant is listening." And the description has Yahweh standing before Samuel. That he is clearly visible is made known by the ending of the chapter. And Samuel grew up, and Yahweh was with him. He did not allow any of his prophecies to go unfulfilled. All Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, realized that Samuel was faithful as a prophet to Yahweh. And Yahweh appeared again in Shiloh, for Yahweh revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh through the word of Yahweh. 1 Samuel 3:19-21. I was amazed the first time I saw this passage for what it was really saying. Yahweh appeared to Samuel with regularity in verse 21. The first verse of the chapter makes a clear association between the word of the Lord and a visionary experience, not a mere auditory event. The idea of the visible world, the visible Yahweh in human form, is nailed down by the standing language. Some passages go beyond presenting Yahweh in visible human form. Genesis 18 is perhaps the most startling example where Yahweh is not only visible, but embodied. And Yahweh appeared to Abram by the oaks of Mamre. And he was sitting in the doorway of the tent at the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, three men were standing near him. And he saw them and ran from the doorway of the tent to meet them. And he bowed down to the ground, and he said, "My Lord, if I have found favor in your eyes, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest under the tree, and let me bring a piece of bread, then refresh yourself. Afterward, you can pass on once you have passed by with your servant." Then they said, "Do so as you have said." Genesis 18:1-5. That one of these three men is Yahweh is evident from the first verse. That the appearance of Yahweh and his two companions is physical is telegraphed by the request to wash their feet and partake in a meal, verses 4 and 5, which they subsequently do, verse 8. The narrator and the reader, of course, know that one of the men is Yahweh, but does Abraham? That he does is made clear from the conversation he has with the embodied Yahweh. After their meal, the other two men, who we discover are angels in Genesis 19, leave to go to Sodom. Once Abraham discerns that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is imminent, he objects out of concern for his nephew Lot, a resident of Sodom. Addressing the Yahweh figure, Abraham says in verse 24, "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to kill the righteous with the wicked, that the righteous would be as the wicked? Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do justice?" Abraham knows the person before him is the judge of all earth, since he addresses his plea directly. He addresses the figure as "you" twice before the rhetorical question that invokes the divine title. How did Abraham know that the figure before whom he stood was Yahweh? The chronology of his encounters in Genesis would tell us that he had heard Yahweh's voice before. This oral recognition is present in other passages involving Abraham that we'll see in a moment. But I also think Abraham visually recognized his visitor from those previous encounters. One final example from the Old Testament of an embodied Yahweh, who is the Word, is far less known, but no less dramatic. In Jeremiah 1, the prophet is called to service. He writes that the word of Yahweh came to him and said, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you came out from the womb, I consecrated you. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Jeremiah identifies this word as Yahweh himself when he replies, Ah, Lord Yahweh, I do not know how to speak, for I am a youth. Verse 6. Yahweh, the word, tells him to not be afraid, and then something shocking happens. Jeremiah writes in verse 9 that Yahweh, the word, stretched out his hand. He touched my mouth. Sounds don't reach out and touch people. This is the language of a physical embodied presence. Whispers of a Godhead. These passages raise three questions. First, it's one thing to see that Yahweh appears in human form, even to the point of embodiment. But what is the logic of this language? In other words, why do this? Second, how is it that if the word was Yahweh and the word was visible and embodied, Jews of Jesus' day could not tolerate the notion that Jesus was Yahweh incarnate on earth? While Yahweh was still in heaven, after all, Jesus prayed to the Father and spoke of the Father, Yahweh of Israel, in the third person. How could a Jew accommodate this Bitarian idea that essentially there were two Yahwehs, one invisible and in heaven, the other on earth in visible form? Third, does this help or harm the New Testament articulation of a Trinity? Was the Trinity a new idea? The answer to these questions are all found in the Old Testament. What we've begun to uncover in this chapter are whispers of the idea of a Godhead. In the Old Testament, the Bible of Judaism, those whispers will get much louder as we continue.